Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're plunging into a figure whose name, well, most of us know it, but the full story is often overshadowed by his most defining role, Jefferson Davis.
Right. A really complex figure.
Yeah, it's time to peel back some of those layers, you know.
Exactly. And for this deep dive, we've sifted through quite a collection of sources, articles, historical research, personal accounts.
Mm-hmm.
The goal isn't just to list what he did, but to try and understand who he was, what shaped him. And honestly, the contradictions are, well, they're pretty startling sometimes. You should prepare for some genuine aha moments.
Okay, so our mission today, let's unpack this, is to go beyond the headlines, explore the surprising depths of a man right at the center of one of America's most, well, tumultuous periods.
Absolutely.
We'll try to navigate the complexities, give you a balanced perspective on someone celebrated by some, reviled by others, cut through the noise, deliver the key insights.
Sounds like a plan.
So let's start at the beginning. Jefferson Phoenix Davis, born June 3rd, 1808, Christian County, Kentucky.
And what's really striking, he was born less than 100 miles from Abraham Lincoln.
Wow.
And only about 8 months earlier, his family moved around a bit, ended up in Mississippi, youngest of 10 kids.
10, that's a lot.
Yep. And his father was a Revolutionary War veteran.
Okay, so there's a certain background there already. What about his education?
Well, it was varied. Boarding schools, one back in Kentucky, Transylvania University, eventually West Point.
West Point, how does he do there?
He was adequate, you could say. Finished 23rd in a class of 34 back in 1828. But the key thing from West Point, he formed some really enduring friendships, which is interesting given his later reputation, you know.
Yeah, that is interesting. So after West Point, military career starts.
Uh-huh. Frontier duty. He actually missed the main action of the Black Hawk War in 32. He was ill.
Unlike Lincoln, right. Lincoln was involved.
Exactly. But Davis came back in time to escort Chief Black Hawk into captivity. And here's a fascinating detail. Black Hawk himself apparently recalled, "Davis treated us all with much kindness."
Hmm. That really doesn't fit the usual mold, does it?
It doesn't. Now, his personal life, it took a tragic turn pretty early. 1835, he marries Sarah Knox Taylor.
Zachary Taylor's daughter.
Yeah.
The future president.
The very same. And Taylor, her father, objected to the marriage.
Oh, awkward.
Very. But sadly, just months after the wedding, both Jefferson and Sarah got malaria. And she died.
Oh, terrible.
Yeah. So Davis becomes quite reclusive for about 8 years, goes back to Mississippi, becomes a cotton planter on his Briarfield plantation. His wealthy older brother, Joseph, was a big influence then.
And this is where he becomes a slaveholder.
Firmly established as one, yes. Mm. He later remarried Verena Howell in 1845.
Okay, so after those reclusive years.
Yeah.
The Mexican War pulls him back into public life.
It does, dramatically. And this is where, you know, you really see his military side come out. War breaks out in 46. He resigns from Congress, commands the 1st Mississippi Regiment.
Serving under his former father-in-law, Taylor.
Yep. Awkwardness, presumably resolved by then. And he shows real valor at the Battle of Buena Vista in 47.
Right, that's the famous one. He was wounded.
Wounded in the foot, yeah. But he gets national acclaim. His regiment used this V formation, helped repulse a big Mexican charge. And General Taylor, who initially didn't want him marrying his daughter,
yeah.
He reportedly said, "My daughter, sir, was a better judge of men than I was."
Wow. That's quite a turnaround.
Tells you something about his performance, doesn't it? And these experiences, they really shaped him. They seem to reinforce this deep-rooted egotism, a real sense of his own merit.
So he already had that sense, and this just solidified it.
Pretty much. He was described as coldly logical, and crucially, he seemed unable to believe that criticism or disagreement could be, you know, sincere or impersonal.
Hmm. That sounds like it could cause problems later.
Definitely. And that military success, especially Buena Vista, it gave him this ineradicable conviction of his own military capability.
And alongside that conviction in himself, what about his views on the South and slavery? How early did those solidify?
Well, his whole upbringing, born into that plantation world, it gave him a total dedication to Southern culture and the institution of slavery. He genuinely saw it as the white man's divinely appointed mission to civilize other races.
Divinely appointed.
He even called it the South's decree of God. It was absolutely fundamental to how he saw the world.
A decree of God. Yeah, that makes compromise pretty difficult, I imagine.
Almost impossible, you'd think. It really locks in his ideology.
Okay, so moving beyond that early life,
mm-hmm.
It's easy to just see him as the Confederate leader, But before that, he was a big deal on the national stage, wasn't he?
Oh, absolutely. Elected to the House in 1845, then the Senate in 47, he was a leading voice for slavery, for states' rights. Even, apparently, it challenged an Illinois congressman to a duel over California becoming a free state.
A duel? Seriously?
That's the sources suggest. But here's the surprising part for many people. His time as Secretary of War.
Right, under President Franklin Pierce.
From 53 to 57. And he was considered really good at it. The most active and effective Secretary of War since the 1820s, according to some historians.
What did he actually do?
Quite a lot. Increased the army's size, improved training, set up a medical corps, oversaw the introduction of the mini ball.
The mini ball. That rifle bullet was a game changer, wasn't it?
Huge impact in the Civil War later. He also pushed for the Gadsden Purchase, adding more territory to the U.S.
This really is the other Jefferson Davis, isn't it? I mean, here's the future Confederate president, but he's working hard to strengthen the United States.
Exactly. He had this transcendent vision of the United States as a great nation, something bigger than just, you know, squabbling states.
He pushed for a stronger national army, served on the board for the Smithsonian. It's a real aha moment. It kind of challenges that simple narrative.
It really does. It shows secession wasn't inevitable for him, not for a long time. And maybe his most lasting national legacy, the U.S. Capitol expansion.
He was involved in that.
Crucially involved. He saw the Capitol not just as office space, but as a symbol. A great nation needed a great seat of government, he thought.
So what was his role?
He got the project moved to the War Department, appointed Captain Montgomery Meigs as the engineer specifically to keep political meddling out.
Smart move.
Yeah, and he made sure they didn't skimp. Marble facade, Brumidi's frescoes inside the works. There's even a story about the statue on top of the dome.
Oh, yeah, the Statue of Freedom.
That's the one. The sculptor first designed it with a liberty cap, like the kind freed slaves wore in ancient Rome. Davis objected. He said something like, "We were always free, not freedmen, not slaves, just released."
Huh. Interesting perspective.
So the final statue became Freedom Triumphant in War and Peace. You can still see it today.
So this period, it really shows the complexity, doesn't it? He's defending Southern interests, slave states' rights, very strongly. But he's also building a national profile, working for the Union.
Right. And sources say that right up until Mississippi seceded in January 61, he was seen as a moderating voice, someone who never urged separation, who actually labored to keep the Union together.
Paints a very different picture, yeah.
A man pulled in different directions by the crisis.
Okay, so despite those efforts, his path leads him to become the Confederate president in February 1861.
But it sounds like he wasn't exactly angling for the job.
No, not really. Our sources suggest he didn't seek it, didn't particularly want it. He actually preferred a military command.
So why him?
He was seen as a compromise candidate by the convention in Montgomery, Alabama, someone acceptable to different factions. But, you know, you have to wonder why he took it, given the circumstances.
Because the challenges were immense, right from the start.
Immense is putting it mildly. Someone compared his situation to the captain of the Titanic. He was up against the North's huge advantages. Population, industry, railroads, you name it. Objective superiority, as one source put it.
And then there's the built-in problem of leading a war effort based on states' rights.
Yeah.
Exactly. That's the core contradiction. The South was this rural agrarian society. Weak institutions, low taxes, people focused on your local areas. How do you fight a massive centralized war with that foundation?
It sounds almost impossible. Did that tension cause problems right away?
Constant problems. Plus, there was this just shocking miscalculation in the South about how the war would go.
They thought it would be quick.
Most did. Confident of a quick and decisive victory. Davis, though, was apparently one of the few who feared a long and bloody conflict. But the Confederate Congress, full of these incredibly wealthy planters, refused to levy serious taxes.
Which led to?
Runaway inflation, crippling financial weakness. Not exactly helpful for governing.
And on top of all that, his personality seems to have been a factor, this prickly personality you mentioned.
Yeah, and apparently made worse by searing headaches caused by facial neuralgia. He even admitted it himself. When I am aroused in a matter, I lose control of my feelings and become personal.
Oof. Not ideal for a wartime leader dealing with massive stress and egos.
Definitely not. And it really affected his relationships with his generals. He got along well with Robert E. Lee, a close relationship.
But not others.
Not so much with guys like Beauregard or Joseph E. Johnston. There was conflict, and it apparently would only intensify and become more personal as the war went on.
It makes you think about leadership styles.
Well, the historian James McPherson points out a fascinating difference. He suggests Davis could never forget a slight or forgive the man who committed it. Lincoln, on the other hand, was apparently willing to hold the horse of a haughty general if he would only win victories.
That's a really telling comparison, isn't it? Pragmatism versus holding grudges.
Something like that. And speaking of generals, this issue of excessive loyalty to some bad generals keeps coming up.
Braxton Bragg, right. He's often cited.
He's the prime example. Widely seen as maybe the Confederacy's worst commander, his subordinates apparently unanimously wanted him gone, but Davis stuck by him. It just defied common sense, according to one analysis.
Any idea?
Hard to know for sure. Maybe that conviction in his own judgment, again, his own military sense. But in terms of overall strategy, he and Lee developed this offensive-defensive approach.
What did that mean exactly?
Basically, defending Confederate territory, but doing it partly by launching strategic attacks into the north. Think Gettysburg, Antietam.
Was it successful?
Well, it was costly, very costly in terms of manpower, which the South couldn't afford. And ultimately, it didn't overcome the Union's advantages, but it did help the Confederacy reverse Union gains early in 62, and it probably prolonged the war as long as was possible through conventional means. Davis wasn't big on guerrilla warfare, though.
Okay, so challenges in the field. What about troubles at home?
Just as significant, Davis increasingly angered people by, well, throwing states' rights under the bus when he needed more central power.
Like suspending habeas corpus?
Yeah, he did that on several occasions, just like Lincoln did in the North. And he pushed through a conscription bill in 1862, the first compulsory draft in American history.
That must have gone over well in a nation founded on states' rights.
Not well at all, especially because there was an exemption for owners of 20 or more slaves.
Ah, the rich man's war, poor man's fight. Argument.
Exactly. It caused huge class resentment. On top of that, Davis imposed taxes, regulations, confiscated private property, used martial law. All things received with great hostility because they clashed directly with the supposed justification for the war's states' rights.
It sounds like he was caught in an impossible bind.
Pretty much. But here's another twist, another aha moment, perhaps. Despite all these struggles, some historians argue Davis showed surprising innovation, flexibility, and a willingness to take political risk that far exceeded Abraham Lincoln's.
Really? How so?
His administration fundamentally transformed the South, economically, politically, even culturally to some extent. He built a powerful central government, bigger relative to population, than the U.S. government. He pushed for industrial development to supply the army.
So centralizing power out of necessity, even if it went against the core ideology.
Precisely. And maybe the boldest risk, the most controversial one, came right at the end, the last 6 months of the war.
What was that?
Davis started advocating the arming and freeing of slaves.
Wow. Seriously, arming slaves to fight for the Confederacy.
Yes. If they would fight, they'd be freed. It caused, as you can imagine, often apoplectic outrage among many Southerners. One prominent senator basically asked, what did we go to war for, if not to protect our property?
That really hits the core contradiction, doesn't it? It raises that fundamental question. How far do you go? How much of your founding principles do you abandon just to survive?
It's a profound question for any leader in crisis.
So despite those desperate measures, the Confederacy obviously collapses. Davis evacuates Richmond, April 2nd, 1865. Union troops are closing in.
But he was still trying to fight on, even then. Determined to keep some form of resistance going.
But it didn't last long. He was captured.
May 10th, by Union cavalry, near Irwinville, Georgia. About 5 weeks after Lee's surrender.
And then imprisonment.
2 years at Fort Monroe, Virginia. And initially, it was harsh. He was put forcibly in irons for 5 days.
Wow. Was he ever tried for treason?
No. Interestingly, it never went to trial. There were apparently complex constitutional issues about whether secession itself legally counted as treason. Would a trial actually succeed? The federal government decided not to risk it.
Huh. And his citizenship? Was it ever restored?
Yes, but much, much later, posthumously, in 1978.
So what did he do after prison? Post-war life?
He traveled for a bit, tried his hand at some businesses, mostly failed, famously turned down the presidency of what's now Texas A&M University.
And he wrote a book, right?
Yes, The Rise and Fall of the Confederate Government, published in 1881, a big 2-volume defense of his actions, the Confederacy, states' rights, the whole nine yards.
How was he viewed in the South after the war?
It's remarkable, really. He had this resurrection in public feeling achieved near adulation. He ended up being ranked alongside Lee and Stonewall Jackson as a major Confederate icon.
Despite presiding over the defeat.
Despite the defeat. He spent most of his later years in Mississippi, died in New Orleans in 1889.
So his legacy, it's just incredibly complex, isn't it? You have the argument that he achieved massive political and social change within the Confederacy.
But it was leadership and dedication to an immoral goal. You can't really get away from that.
And his wartime rhetoric certainly didn't help heal wounds.
No, it actively deepened the intersectional hatred, calling the Emancipation Proclamation an attempt to incite servile insurrection, calling Northerners hyenas, offscourings of the earth. Pretty harsh stuff.
Then there's that quote from near the end of his life.
Right. Just a year before he died, he was speaking to young men in Mississippi, and he told them to lay aside all rancor, all bitter sectional feeling, and work towards a reunited country.
What do you make of that after everything?
It's poignant. Maybe a hint of reconciliation. A final wish for unity from the man who led the fight for division. It's another one of those contradictions.
What a journey, then. Frontier boy, war hero, Secretary of War, reluctant president, lost cause symbol. A man of just intense conviction, but riddled with contradictions.
Absolutely. He seems to embody the very divisions he fought to maintain.
So wrapping this up, if we connect this to the bigger picture, what does Davis's story tell us? His shift from national leader to sectional one, that unwavering belief in his own rightness. What does it say about leadership, about compromise, especially when things are really falling apart?
That's the key question, isn't it? It really makes you think about how deeply held personal beliefs can be a driving force, but also a massive hindrance, how they can prevent compromise, maybe even blind you. And it highlights the lasting damage when fundamental societal conflicts aren't truly resolved. Something for you, the listener, to ponder, definitely.
Indeed. We hope this deep dive has given you a richer, maybe more complicated understanding of Jefferson Davis. Keep exploring, keep questioning.
And keep diving deep.